a pitch pong where it's at a call.
You know, it's funny. I haven't watched much of anything by myself because stuff was off all this week, but we did jump into a few things. I've got some Criterions kind of loading up. Like, I'm still kind of going in and out of watching some Varda stuff, and I tried to start the War trilogy. That hasn't happened yet, and I wanted to get into that. And I think, you know, probably going to get into some more French film. So I think that's about it.
French, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you get much from the sale, the Barnes & Noble sale?
Yeah. Well, I got pretty much everything because, you know, being Criterion Complete, I got everything that I didn't have, all the new stuff. So
stocked up.
Complete through Breaking Point. Yeah. That's the
Congratulations.
Yeah. So.
Well, we're on an episode. What number is this? 30? I think it's 30.
Is it 30 now?
29 or 30. I guess you guys will see by the the file that's in your podcast player. You probably know better than us. So this is actually a bonus episode. We recorded this, was it a month ago?
I think it was a month ago, yeah. I was going to somewhere on that.
We had some technical glitches, and then Mark and I went on vacations, so we just couldn't get together. So this episode is with Josh Larson from Film Spotting, and I think it's a really good episode. I think it's a different perspective on film because we got into some religion and umbrellas of Cherbourg and anything else you remember? Well, I guess people are about to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, that was it. Josh had released a book called Movies Are Prayers, and he was kind of doing the tour, you know, joining some podcasts, getting the word out about it. And, you know, you and I had picked it up and checked it out, and we just wanted to talk about it. And Umbrellas happened to be one of the movies that was in the book, so it seemed like a good pick, plus was, you know, one of his favorites. So, yeah, it was great to have him on.
Yeah, it was fun. And we got into more religion about film, or films about religion, religion about film. And also a little bit of Criterion stuff. So I think it was a lot of fun. It wasn't as now-y as a lot of our episodes, which makes it work for a bonus episode. So because it's a little outdated, there are probably some references that have already sailed. I think we predicted Grand Budapest Hotel for Spy 900, so...
You're quite wrong with that one. But
we missed the boat there. In fact, I think it might be a while because he's working on that that movie. What's it called? It's coming out in March.
Oh, yeah, I forget.
I didn't prep my Wes Anderson movies, but he has a movie that was just bumped up to March, so he's probably busy. And I should also say that we had, I wouldn't say technical problems, but the call, the way we did the recording was a little different, so... Just FYI, the levels on here might be a little different. Some people's volumes might be a little wonky. So apologies, but I still think it's a good listen. I think Josh was a great guest. Really enjoy his insights and really erudite thoughts. So
he's a longtime writer and, you know, been talking on podcasts for a few years now. So definitely knows his stuff.
So thank you, Josh, for joining us, and everybody, get ready for the show. Enjoy. So you're going to see Baby Driver later, huh? So you saw it once already?
Yeah, so I went, I guess it wasn't opening day because I think it opened on a Wednesday, but I went because I thought we were going to be doing it for Film Spotting, and we still are. It just got pushed back a week. So I saw it early on, but then Debbie, my wife, regrets that she did not see it. we're going to go watch it again, and, you know, that's good because we're recording our review of it next week for Film Spotting, so it can never hurt to see something twice.
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah, I've noticed there was adoration, and then there was a little bit of backlash. I guess that's always the way things go now. And I saw Bourdain hates it. Did you guys see that?
That was funny. Yeah. Yes.
In a
it was
fun
just
way.
A tweet, right?
Yeah. Yeah, very short review. But
140 characters.
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the early responses, at least, you know, gauging, everyone has their own filter, so who knows what this means depending on where you see early reviews, but they were just ecstatic, like, you know, 5 stars on Letterboxd and stuff like that. So I think when more people actually saw it, maybe the expectations were set a little higher.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I'll be curious to see it again because I was... you know, I enjoyed it quite a bit, but it's probably at the, you know, towards the bottom of Edgar Wright's films for me. I think there's some fantastic stuff in it, but a pretty steep drop off from that stuff. So I'll see what I make of it, though, the second time.
Yeah, hard to match up with Scott Pilgrim, in my opinion. Well,
hey, I'm right there with you. That's sweet. My favorite of his.
Well, I guess this is the show. So that was Josh Larson from Film Spotting. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you.
And editor at Think Christian as well. And we have my good friend, Mark Herney. Hey, Mark.
Hey. Hello, hello. Glad to be here and talking to you again, Aaron, and talking to Josh.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Both you guys. And Josh just released a book called Movies Are Prayers. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give Mark the host cap, and you go ahead and lead us into this, Mark.
Oh, cool. All right. Thanks, Aaron. Also, I should mention Josh wears many hats. He also has Larson on Film, where he writes film reviews. And I think you, I don't, many other things that you do, Josh. So it's nice to have you on. You were my first intro to film podcasting, you and Adam with mm-hmm. Film Spotting. So you gave me the bug. So I thank you for that.
Yeah, All right. We will take the credit / blame for that, I guess.
You guys are icons, truly. So glad to have you.
Oh, wow. Too kind.
Yeah, seriously.
It's very nice. And Josh is actually one of the only podcasters that I've ever met in person, along with you, Aaron, since you made the trek here to Vermont in August. I was there for the Film Spotting 500th show, so I was able to meet Josh in person. That was a ton of fun. Sweet. In Chicago.
Yeah, a couple of years ago now, so time's gone by. You'll have to come back out.
Yeah, right. That's some point. Got to do it.
It sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe
yeah,
the guys, too.
Yep. Yeah, actually got to meet up with them. Yeah, be a good time. So I think the video's out there somewhere on the interwebs. I'm sitting there with Rye the movie guy, and I think I captured a picture at one point of Ryan Johnson, his large head behind Adam and Josh there during yeah. Film Spotting 500.
Nice.
It was a lot of
fun.
Yeah,
he skyped in for that. That was great.
Yeah. And that was like just after he had, you know, been announced as the Last Jedi director.
Right. So, when we managed to get him to come on, that hadn't even been announced yet, I don't think.
Right.
So that was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm hoping for good things. I'm not expecting too much from Trevorrow, but you never know.
You never know. He's got some good material to work with. So who knows?
He does.
But so welcome, Josh. And we wanted to have you on, especially so around the time of your most recent book, Movies Are Prayers. We were just talking. Aaron's copy came in from he ordered his from Audible. I just got my print copy today. And it's titled Movies Are Prayers, How Films Voice Our Deepest Longings, with a foreword from Matt Zollersites. So it's very cool. I'm really looking forward to digging into this. And so we figured we'd have you on to talk a bit about the book. We also were going to get a little bit into some of your Criterion connections. You have some favorites, some favorite Criterion movies. And I know I was looking at the index. Many of them are mentioned within the book, not surprisingly, because, you know, religious experiences and Criterion go hand in hand. And we will touch on, you did talk about Umbrellas of Cherbourg a bit. So I know it's mentioned in the book, so we will touch on that a little bit. That was kind of a movie we were going to talk a little bit about. And that'll probably close us out. So
sounds good.
Josh, tell us a little bit about the book. I mean, I know you've been on quite a few podcasts and plugging it a lot on Film Spotting. You know, again, really what the impetus was for writing this. I believe this is your first book and really looks great. Just tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, it is my first, and it's a larger attempt to do the sort of film criticism that I regularly do at Think Christian, which is a faith and culture website. So that's, you know, obviously a little different than the criticism we do at Film Spotting, which is for a mainstream audience and is more of the type that I've done the majority of my career from college on through about 2011. I worked for a Chicago area newspaper or other mainstream outlets, and then joined Think Christian in 2011 and started to really think about, okay, how am I going to write about films specifically through a Christian lens? And fumbled my way through that for a little while, tried some avenues that maybe weren't so successful. The idea for Movies our prayers. I had prior to that, though, it was just this general notion of, and it came out of really my experience of movies this way, where I saw that they were almost functioning as my surrogate in some instances for the prayers that I would offer, say, in church, or would offer, you know, even outside of church as well, these instinctual prayers that we all, I believe, really offer. And I thought, well, that's interesting that, you know, there seems to be this parallel in terms of the functionality here. And I wonder if you could be more methodical about it and really break down different types of prayer and then say what movies work as those mm-hmm. types of prayer. So it was an idea I had for a while, toyed around with a bit, but it wasn't until, you know, maybe 2 years ago or so, had an opportunity through InterVarsity Press to really, you know, explore it in full.
Yeah, I think it works just to break the films down into like little thematic categories. So I'm about a third of the way through, and I think I'm I think you just talked about Children of Men, I believe, maybe a little
okay.
bit.
Okay,
oh,
yep.
And Bergman, of course. And it's actually interesting in that you did not this is not just Christian films. You know, this is you might get to a Passion of the Christ. You might get to God's Not Dead, but it's more about expressions of religion in film. So, yeah, I think it's actually a pretty unique film book, and I've actually quite enjoyed it.
Well, thanks. Yeah, that was intentional. I wanted to explore films that were not overtly religious. So there are, you know, a handful here and there that do touch on religion or have religious characters or explicitly religious themes, mm-hmm. but they're in the vast minority. Mostly I wanted to look at different movies across all eras, across all genres, and see how they might function as these various forms of prayer.
Yeah, it's funny to see. I mean, I'm looking at the index and some of the prayers that you mentioned. You know, there's some that I'm drawn to especially would be, you know, Prayers of Yearning. Of course, I see the first one there is my favorite mm-hmm. film, 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
And there's a lot there. I mean, you know, with some Criterion connections, you've got Hiroshima Mon Amour in there, you know, In the Mood for Love, Last Year at Marion Bad. So
the Unrequited Love section, that was good.
Yeah, some really good ones there.
That's where I kind of handled those films as Prayers of Yearning, in the sense that, you know, the earthly love, especially unrequited love, mm-hmm. can mimic the more spiritual unrequited yearning that we have for answers, for connection. And I just argue that, again, this idea of a movie like that, yes, it's romantic on a human-to-human level, but can also serve as a surrogate to capture mm-hmm. that sort of yearning. And of course, science fiction was where I started with that chapter, because
right. sure.
that's the root of such so many great sci-fi films from, like you mentioned, Mark, 2001, which I just saw last weekend again in 70mm at the Music Box here in Chicago. Yeah,
jealous.
It was great experience. So, you know, films like that, which we can debate too, like how much there's certainly yearning in there, but Kubrick being such a pessimist in my mind, it almost gets squashed, I feel, by his sensibility in the end. But something like Close Encounters of the Third Kind is absolutely a movie yeah. that expresses yearning
yep.
and Contact, The Fountain. So, yeah, it was exciting to me when writing the book to take a general idea like yearning and prayers of yearning that we offer, which I would argue is maybe the most universal prayer that people who would say they aren't even a person of faith still expresses mm-hmm. this. And to see how it could be modeled by something like 2001, A Space Odyssey, and it could also be modeled by something like Hiroshima Mon Amour. So yeah. that was a really, you know, rewarding part of the project for me.
Yeah, I mean, who hasn't considered, you know, our place in the world? You know, that's the prayer of, you know, trying to understand. I guess I think of it a little bit too. The film, which for me was the most recent religious experience I had, the movie Silence from Scorsese, and
I
just
thought about that
you
one
know,
too, yeah,
yeah, it's been on my mind ever, you know, since thinking about this book that mm-hmm. you know that just that silence of which translates, you know, really to me into that yearning to understand, you know, where I am, why I'm here, and why is God, you know, ultimately silent?
Yeah,
you know, he doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say that's a good example because it shows how yearning can apply to a person of faith as well. So, you know, I write about how the argument that people, everyone does have this within them, like an atheist who might deny the existence of God still asks these questions. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that a person of faith, like the characters, the priests in Silence, it doesn't mean that they don't as well. They're just, you know, maybe coming from a little different angle, or their questions are rooted in their belief, but it's not as if people of faith have every answer. You know, I think a lot of us would describe our faith as saying we have a hope that we lean into and root our lives in, but there's still going to be questions, and there's still going to be yearning and wondering. And I think that's the sort that Silence captures.
And yeah. I think it kind of sidesteps author intent as well, which, and I'm married to an English professor. I talk about her all the time, but that comes up a lot when we're just looking at different texts. And I think probably half of the filmmakers, I call them authors, but filmmakers that you talk about, maybe more, are not theists. But I think that's just part of art film, and is that you can extract inspiration from that. And I think that's people like me and you, Mark, and I don't know if you approach it from a religious sensibility, but we are looking for inspiration and meaning when we watch these films. Not when we're watching like The Naked Gun, but Silence, we're hoping for a little something special to move us. So, yeah, I think it's a good survey of religion. Well done, and I encourage other people to read it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the authorial intent question is, you know, I completely agree that that's something, while we honor that, and when we maybe write from an auteurist perspective, that's exactly what we're doing, is wanting to examine those authorial imprints. I do that myself. But at the same time, you know, I believe that by the time a movie is released and it's gone through so many creative hands, even if there's a firm directorial hand at the helm, it does become its own thing, and therefore it becomes open to other interpretations. Now, you have to be careful with that, and that's one of the things that I worried about with this book, is I didn't want to hijack these titles and say, you know, bring in something completely out of bounds, or say that this is exactly what the movie means and it can only mean this. And so my method of avoiding that was to try to root my arguments in details from the form of the films and the choices that the filmmakers made, so that at least I was honoring and working from what they had given, rather than kind of trying to bring an idea and force it upon a film. So, you know, some people might read parts of the book where they'll say, yeah, but you didn't pull that off here. I think that is one of the things that I had to learn to do when I started writing from this angle as well. And I'm sure I have more learning to do on that end, but it was at least one of the concerns I had when going into this project.
Yeah. And basically author intent and really the work transcending the author is, I think, a cornerstone of English. So, and I think the argument there is that even if the author could be a stout atheist, or could be, what do they call people that hate Christ, that they're still influenced by society and religious or society. So, and it made me think about, I actually took a religion and film class a little while back, a few years back, and reading or listening to your book made me recall a lot of what I learned there. And there are actually a lot of parallels. In fact, I would recommend that rather than spend, the $700 a quarter hour to take the class, I think your book was actually a better primer for survey of religion and film. But basically, what that was actually a religion class. It wasn't a film studies class.
And I see.
And they were using film, and actually some of the filmmakers were not of faith, but there were a lot of the same titles that you mentioned, such as actually Children of Men was in there, Tree of Life, probably many more that I've yet to encounter. There was also there was a Knowing, I remember. I think that's
Cage. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, Nick Cage. You got to have him.
Interesting. Okay.
And I'm not a fan of the movie, but I get it. And actually, they even had Adam Sandler. They had Jack and Jill because they wanted somewhat recent movies, and they wanted one to cover Judaism. So that was one of the few.
Huh.
Yeah. I was.
Interesting.
Was not a fan of studying Jack and Jill. That was pretty rough. But basically, what they were going for was they were showing not just religious messages in film, but religious inspiration and how that coalesced into the film. So, like something like Scorsese, it's all over the place. You know, it's over.
Sure, absolutely.
There's symbols, and there's also and same with like Bergman, but somebody like Adam Sandler, he probably doesn't pay as close attention to the mise-en-scène, but he finds
right.
you know, there are some things in the frame there. So anyway, yeah, it was a good way to compare the two, and I'll continue doing that as I read.
Yeah, great. Definitely.
I wanted to find that syllabus, but I couldn't find it.
One of the other titles that stands out to me, Josh, of course, is there's some more Criterion titles in the meditation and contemplation chapter. And, of course, you did cross over to television, I see, with the Decalogue, which you could just see as, you know, a 10-hour film.
Oh, sure.
That's one that's, it's, yeah, definitely a prayer of meditation. I mean, that's another TV series. Watching that just feels like a complete religious experience. And of course, based on the Ten Commandments.
Yeah. Ten prayers.
Right. Yeah. And
right.
Yeah. Well, you do, like, if you wonder, and I have seen them all, it's been a few years now, but if you could almost try this project on just that series, you know,
Those
are so dense and so rich. And what's interesting about all of those is there seems to be an overtly religious topic or idea, but then it goes about it in such a circuitous way and comes out in places you wouldn't expect that it's really not as messagey as it sounds. You know, here are 10 films about the 10 commandments. That's not really how it reads. Oftentimes the commandments don't seem to match up with the narrative.
Yeah.
And I think that's all to the better. As far as I'm concerned, in really making us consider things like law and grace rather than, you know, particular moral actions necessarily.
Yeah. And there is a character there that, you know, that does show up who may be a form of God or Jesus. He just kind of is there. It's been a while since I've seen it. I can't remember if he's any kind of a guiding force or if he's just a presence that's there, but he does show up in, you know, most, if not all of the episodes. So
yeah, you know, that's right. Yeah. I'd forgotten about that, but there is that figure in the background.
Yep. So yeah, it's, you know, it's we'll definitely get into the book a little bit more. I wanted to give you a chance to plug it. I think it currently is on sale at all book outlets, local book outlets, Barnes & Noble. I got mine at Amazon. You can also get it directly from the publisher, I believe, InterVarsity Press.
Yep.
So lots of options.
Mm-hmm. And yep. We'll put some links in the notes, too, for people to find it.
And Audible, like Aaron found it there.
Right,
so.
Right. Which is kind of the same thing as Amazon these days. But
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, we wanted to, we are going to talk a little bit about The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. I did get into that box set myself. And I know, Josh, you revisited it. But we thought maybe we'd just talk a little bit more about Criterion titles. A lot of folks that listen to this podcast, we will lovingly call them Criterion geeks. So we love everything Criterion from, you know, the packaging to waiting to what's going to be announced each month. I'm waiting with bated breath on the 15th to know what's coming out in 3 months. And there's sales. There's a Barnes & Noble sale this month. And, you know, folks are it's really kind of a rabid fandom. There's our Facebook group, Criterion Now, and a bunch of other groups. And so we definitely key into what is, you know, out there on Criterion. So we're just curious, you know, again, for you, I've seen, in the index, Criterion pervades it. And you have, some of the films, I was actually introduced through the film spotting marathons, like the Satyajit Ray marathon was just life-changing for me. Beautiful. And the Robert Bresson marathon, it was a lot of fun. And some of those titles I know have become penalty box on film spotting because you've talked about them so much.
Yeah, that's true. So I had to get them in the book because I could do whatever I want there, right?
Right, but, exactly. It's your book. Yeah. And here's another opportunity. So
Apu is probably about 10 prayers right there.
Right.
Yeah, I hope that's, you know, it's an indication of the richness of these films, I think. And also, Yeah, you hit upon it. It seems like Criterion does everything from the transfer to the titles to they choose to the packaging, and also I'd include with that the artwork, you know, often the posters that they'll put out. It's just top-notch from top to bottom. But I'm probably going to lose a lot of respect from you guys when I say I think I probably own like 15 Criterion discs.
Oh, and that's respectable.
That's not bad. Yeah, yeah.
Bad. I'm sure
it's all probably right. A great 15.
Well, it's mostly every Wes Anderson film I think that's been put out. I'm not sure you guys would probably know offhand if all of them thus far have been or haven't. All
except for Grand Budapest,
which might be coming out. We think maybe Spine 900. We'll see.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, I would imagine it'd be pretty soon. So I obviously have all of those. I do have Umbrellas. Because it is one of my favorite films of all time. Seven Samurai, I recently got as a gift, and the Apu trilogy, of course. So a lot of these are, you know, I guess it's weird for someone who does this, you know, mostly as a job. I'm seeing things on the fly so often, and it's, you know, like immediate need, like what do I need to see for next week's show? What do I need to see for this essay that's due? That I don't really have the luxury or the downtime to like curate a collection, which is, you know, somewhat sad. Sometimes I see these titles coming out and think, man, I would love to kind of approach them this way. So yeah, most often I'll get them as gifts from my family. And that's always a delight because I know I do want to dig into them, and I'm probably more inclined to read the pamphlets and the extra material there. I'm not a huge extras viewer on discs, and I think maybe this comes a little bit into what we were talking about, the authorial intent conversation, because sometimes when I get too deep into that stuff, it erases the potential mystery for that movie again, certainly, and maybe even for that director's future films if it's someone who's an active director. So I try to be a little careful with that. That said, we watched as a family the Fantastic Mr. Fox Criterion maybe 3 weeks ago and couldn't help ourselves. We just all, everyone dug right into the extras on that because you're just dying to know the intricacies of the stop motion animation there, right? And the choices they made and how they pulled that stuff off.
And they have great extras on that disc. And in fact, if you click, I don't know if you did, but I think it's called Film Analysis. Do you remember that, Mark?
Yeah.
It's two kids. It's,
I haven't
it's
seen
the
that
cutest
for a while,
thing
but...
ever. Yeah.
Oh, we didn't, his see that one. So
yeah, that's because
that must be on another...
It's on the Criterion, but it seems like, it sounds like the most boring one on the menu, but it's actually the cutest, so...
Okay, we'll have to go back to that one.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. I mean, it's not one that you hear a lot from folks that would watch or buy Criterion in watching the supplements, Josh. But I really appreciate that. I can understand how there's been many times, especially, you know, podcasting on Criterion Close-Up and now where we'll have watched all the supplements. And, you know, you put that disc on your shelf and it kind of makes – you're, you know, making me think, and I just thought has crossed my mind, will I really pull that disc off the shelf and watch the, maybe I'll never watch the supplements again. Or, and, you know, it certainly has colored my, appreciation, of the film. You know, so is it one that I really feel like I'm going to need to revisit, soon? I guess, you know, generally I found that it's deepened my appreciation for the film, although some of the supplements are, you know, there is some redundancy built in sometimes. But I've certainly found that the majority of my reading these days is, you know, I need to save as much time for watching movies. So a lot of it is the essays in the booklets. So I'm with you. I definitely appreciate those.
Yeah, those are fantastic. And I will say, too, like, I think the supplements that I have to watch are on films like Fantastic Mr. Fox or other Anderson ones where it's a film I have probably exhausted my opinion on, if that makes any sense. I've just watched it so many times. I know it so well that then I am ready to have, you know, a little bit of a different or a deeper look on it, or let that authorial intent seep in. Though, you know, that's not, someone like Anderson is such a cagey director. have and read Matt Zeller Seitz's books, Wes Anderson books, because I know even though those, I mean, they're similarly packaged like Criterion, right? They just look gorgeous. Yeah. But I also know Anderson is not one of these filmmakers who feels the need to explain his work. And so you can read a whole interview with him and it's not necessarily going to come across as this is what I meant and this is how you should feel about it. And I think I like those sorts of forays into supplemental material a little bit better.
Yeah, the one thing about the Criterion supplements, I think they're all well done and they all bring a little dimension to the film. But I guess they also influence, they pretty much paint the narrative of how you're going to interpret the film. And so sometimes I try not to watch too much because I want to come to my own conclusions. However, sometimes I'll watch 3 hours of supplements and turn a film that I hated into a film I love. So there's that.
That happens a lot.
Yeah. That is a good point. And I think maybe that's the best case for them is, you know, if there's a film you've tried once or twice and just either, you know, you don't get or rubs you the wrong way, then that's the time to hit the supplements and see, okay, what am I missing here?
Yeah,
what is the appreciative angle on this, you know?
That's exactly it. So Jules and Jim, we have a date.
Yeah, we got to talk about that one day. No. Yeah, I've been on record of saying I've never seen a bad Criterion film, and I, you know, they curate these films. Someone there has picked a film for a reason, and the supplements help. I really support that. So, you know, whether I like or love it, and sometimes, like you said, Aaron, after watching the supplements, I'll love it. So, curious, Josh, you know, you mentioned prepping for film spotting and writing. So you don't typically buy discs. You'll receive them as gifts. So, you know, when you're watching movies, like going into like the Agnes Varda marathon, I know they were showing a couple of the films on Mubi. Do you have a Filmstruck subscription or do you get some movies from the library, or just curious about access for you?
Yeah, I end up doing it all. So thankfully, we do have a partnership with Mubi that for the film spotting marathons, we can sometimes get access to titles a little bit early. So that was helpful for the Agnes Varda marathon. I do have a Filmstruck membership as well. And I know that when we did the Louise Buñuel marathon, it was helpful there. I forget which title it was, but there was one for sure. I think it was Robinson Crusoe was on there. So yeah, Mubi is great for access. Filmstruck has been helpful. And the public library is like the forgotten goldmine, I feel like. Yeah. My wife worked at a public library for a couple of years. And, you know, even if the one in your town isn't necessarily well-stocked, most states or counties have interlibrary loan systems, and you can just get online and, you know, you'll find that there's a crossover among librarians and film fanatics. So the way that benefits us is that when they get to order the titles, they usually pick out some good stuff. And you'll find that there's one library in your system, hopefully, that someone's curated really smartly, and you can get that delivered to your local library. You know, there's a time lag when you do that. So you kind of have to be, at least if it's like often for me, hooked on a deadline for a show or something, you kind of have to plan ahead to make that work.
I do the same. But,
it's, you know, I think people forget about that option, and it's definitely still a good one, even in this day and age of streaming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's about access.
It's my Netflix queue nowadays. I just put it on the library queue, and a month or two, it'll arrive. So
There you go. Yeah. Yep.
I haven't had Netflix DVD for a long time because just for that reason, you know, it's like supplementing all that streaming.
And I feel like their DVD library has been getting paltrier and paltrier too. Netflix, and I think probably intentionally, you know, they're looking to, I would assume, move out of that business altogether. So, that's not as great of a resource anymore.
Yeah. As far as Criterion access too, I mean, a lot of libraries, like my local library, purchased the big Janus box set, you know, 50 years of Janus films. And you'll find that the library curation, they typically, understand. I mean, not all of them, but a lot of them understand the need for international film, and a lot of that'll bring in a lot of Criterion movies. So it's a great resource. It's one I found, you know, following the film spotting marathons, especially when there is some Criterion crossover. It's always a resource for at least half the movies, you know, that I've watched.
Yeah, I think that's where the Criterion brand is helpful, you know, so that libraries see that, and it's a stamp of approval for them to add it to their collection.
Yeah, and our library gets all the Criterion collection and numerous copies, and they also get Kino and Coen and so forth.
Nice.
So yeah, it's really a tremendous luxury. That's one thing we're blessed with these days, is just unlimited access to film. It's just really amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Streaming or you know, disc. So.
Yeah. So why don't we talk a little bit about The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Again, we will just touch on Agnes Varda a little bit after. So, you know, we didn't want to get into it too much, but, you know, would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about a film. Folks know The Umbrellas of Cherbourg recently re-released in a separate edition from Criterion, along with The Young Girls of Rochefort, probably to coincide with the popularity of La La Land. I have a little story about that I'll mention in a little bit. But yeah, so nice to see that they brought that out. And this was an excuse for me personally to just, you know, dig into that mammoth box set. It's still dual format, 13 discs out there. So yeah, I thank you, Josh, for picking the movie, so I had a reason to watch this.
sure.
So, but yeah, and it's, you know, just from the colors of this thing, I had never seen a Demy film. So I watched Lola and Bay of Angels, and then this one was just so eye-opening for me. I've just been singing the music ever since. So just curious, you know, any other thoughts that you have on The Umbrellas of Cherbourg? I know it's come up a number of times on Film Spotting. It's one of your favorite films. And I think you came to it just recently. Curious what your first viewing was of Umbrellas, Josh.
I think it was less than 10 years ago, 10 years ago at the most. And it was sort of one of the confirmation. I was slow to come to musicals, you know, even as a movie lover who got serious about film in high school. That was one of the genres, probably along with Westerns, maybe, where I was just a little skeptical. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't my thing. I'm not musical by nature. And it took me a while to get over the whole stop talking, start singing thing. You know, all the idiotic stuff that I hear other people say now, I used to say before. But slowly I came around on them. And I think that when I finally saw Umbrellas, it kind of sealed the deal for me, you know. And I think it was because of its all-out commitment to the musical form. I mean, this is Demy really trying to out-musical the Hollywood musical. So there's not a spoken line of dialogue in the picture. You mentioned the colors, Mark. It's just such an intense commitment. I mean, it's going to win you over or scare you away from them forever. And thankfully, I was absolutely won over by it. So just as a movie on its own terms, you know, not even for how it would fit into the book, but just as a movie experience, it was one that made me appreciate the musical form so much more. And I'm so glad, because, you know, it set me up perfectly for something like La La Land, which made my top 10 list last year. I know that's not cool to say right now, but I put it on there and I'm happy it's there. And I think Umbrellas is clearly one of the influential films for it. And rightly so. It's a great one.
Yeah, I agree. It's one of the film. You mentioned the colors, Josh. I keep expecting with your show we'll see more wallpaper on the walls. Some people.
Oh, that wallpaper is crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Barely imagine living in a room like this, but on the screen within the context of this movie, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
That's one place where the supplements really do help. Is just to see how painstaking they were with putting together these sets, and also the music too. The music's just phenomenal. And
Michel Legrand music.
Yeah, yep. All the effort he put into that. I mean, yeah, it really is kind of the gateway musical. I think that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, and then so for the book, where I placed this was as Umbrellas as a Prayer of Joy, and this kind of gets a little theological here, but from a Christian perspective, I talk about prayers of joy as being ones that look forward to the new heaven and the new earth, so coming restoration when things will be made right. And obviously, no movie can fully capture that because we don't fully know what that looks like. But I think that movies and musicals in particular can give us maybe a hint, a glimpse, a taste of what it might be like. And so the fact that movie musicals are not always logical or rational, but are purely experiential, I think they lend themselves to this sensibility. And in Umbrellas, the color, I argue, has everything to do with that, because this is not we're talking about it as being joyous and lively and colorful, but it's really a tragic story, of these young lovers separated by war, and they're, spoiler alert, they're reunited, but not in the way that you expect. Here's, maybe another way it influenced La La Land. But yet, this pastel color scheme persists through the film in the production design. And I think that how that functions as a prayer of joy is this reminder that joy remains no matter what turns that life might take. And it's this idea of looking ahead, there's a sustaining joy. And that's sort of like the theological spin that I put on it to include it in the book. This sense of anticipation, of joyful anticipation that I think we get in Umbrellas, even as the story takes a significant sad turn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's one of those. It's funny. I was just thinking about that today, Josh, when you mentioned the colors and how you kind of expect when we get into part two that the colors will be more muted. But they're not. They're maybe even more glorious as we, get more of the inside of the umbrella shop. So, it's to that point, like you said, there is still joy to be found in life, even if you're when you're at your, potentially your lowest. And, won't say anything much more about the end, but the end is just, it's glorious. It really encapsulates, tragedy, but also, joy, absolutely, like you said.
And life, too. I think that's just part of, and it's really tough to talk about this movie without talking about the ending, but it's a rite of passage. These things happen, so.
The way I describe it when I wrote on my website is, it's this story of naive young love, but it's seen through the affectionate eyes of experience. Mm-hmm. So it's made by people who have gone through this and are looking at it from the other side, not people who are right in the midst of that infatuation or the loss in the moment. There's a sense of experience, at least from the movie's perspective, if not the characters.
Certainly. Yeah. But you kind of feel like I felt like watching this for the first time, like I was watching my life flash before my eyes, because I feel like I've had all of these experiences. And, it's not often that you, your first love is your last love. So it's in watching it, too. I watched it with my daughter and wife recently. I think you just rewatched it with your family, Josh. I'm curious their takes. My daughter, I thought she would be on board watching this with La La Land in tow. She didn't love La La Land, but she liked it a lot. I think part of it was she really liked Ryan Gosling. I mean, who, what 13-year-old girl doesn't? But it was really, sometimes I think it's the French. She had a hard time with Beauty and the Beast and just the constant singing. She wanted musical numbers, and I've got to show her young girls, so it didn't quite catch with her. And I wonder if part of it too is just the, the melancholy turn, that we see similar to La La Land, but maybe that didn't quite resonate. But as a, as an adult, it absolutely resonates. And I'll be curious to see her see this again, in 10 or 20 years and see what her take is. But unfortunately for her, it was more of a prayer of endurance than joy. But
yeah, I mean, I think it went over well in my house, but not enthusiastically either. And certainly not on the level of La La Land, which is, just one of the favorites around here. I think maybe it has something to do with the fact that what we were just talking about, until you can look at this movie through the lens of experience too. It doesn't resonate quite with you as much. But I think you're definitely onto something about the lack of big production numbers. They have seen Young Girls of Rochefort as well. And I don't know, I didn't ask, but I would imagine maybe liked it a little more because it has some more of the dancing that we don't really get in Umbrellas. So that could be part of it too.
And yeah, the numbers are catchier.
You know, it's a sad story too. And then, yeah, the music is, you know, you do leave humming it. Like you remember it, it's memorable, but it's not, you know, effervescent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Rochefort is the MGM homage, whereas Umbrellas was breaking its own ground. So, as far as
goes,
I could actually see a through line with La La Land and Young Girls more than Umbrellas a little bit.
Mm, okay.
Mm. Yeah, there's certainly those themes of just characters. I mean, you see it throughout his films. Of course, you see a character Roland from Lola come back in this film, and just how the characters are, they never seem to, these characters inhabit his world, but they just kind of subsist. And there are times when they just can't quite connect. You know, it's nice to see a little bit of redemption, I think, for Roland between Lola and Umbrellas. So it's Demi's world. I guess I think of it that way. It's certainly something that you want to delve into. And something I just wanted to mention that I kind of saw a little bit of a through line to someone that you know and mentioned earlier, Josh. And I think it's actually mentioned in the essay, Demi as kind of twee and outdated. And I think of the word twee to describe, I know Wes Anderson's been described twee quite a bit. So,
right.
You know, he was seen as someone who wasn't, in Jacques Demy, the director, someone who wasn't, you know, as serious or as recognized in the French New Wave. I think in retrospect, he's gotten, you know, definitely more, especially with these films coming out again, more renowned. But you know, he wasn't seen as serious, maybe too a bit too in the clouds, so to speak.
He was sort of
and also.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead, Aaron. What were you going to say?
He and actually Varda as well, I think, were more peripheral members of the French New Wave. And you could say the same about René. They weren't front and center. I guess Left Bank New Wave is probably the way to categorize them. But the thing with New Wave is it's such a broad – it's really an era rather than a style. So.
Right.
And if you think about, you know, Demi doing an homage that, yes, may try to out-musical a musical, but it's still deeply rooted in – a particular Hollywood standard when the other filmmakers we think of with the French New Wave, whether Truffaut, Godard, they were like disassembling those previous standards and putting them back together in new ways. So I think, you know, certainly in the midst of that, I can only imagine that this was not as progressive or forward thinking as some of the films that were more exciting in that exact moment.
Yeah, kind of like Moonlight versus La La Land, in a way.
That's right. Maybe, yes.
Yeah.
I do love the opening shot in the film, too. It made me think of, just musically, again, that theme of the you see the characters keep walking past the camera with their umbrellas, but they're never quite connecting, you know, a theme of Demi's. And I thought of, you know, it's raining pretty hard and it's like the sky is crying. And I know that's something that Demi wanted to do. He wanted to make people cry. So yeah, I'll just invoke the Siva Ray Vaughan song, The Sky is Crying, for that opening. It's lovely. It's great.
Yeah. It is one of the all time openers for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you a big fan of his, the rest of his work?
So I think I'm going through the filmography in my head. I think Young Girls might be the only other one I've seen, actually.
Mm. Oh, really?
So that could be fodder for a film spotting marathon of its own.
Nice.
If we ever get a chance to do that.
Yeah, Lola, Bay of Angels. I guess Donkey Skin is worth seeing.
It's an oddity. It's fantastic, but it is worth seeing.
And I really like Enchambre Unville. I'm probably saying that wrong, but that's a 80s version. I think that's more stylistically in tune with Umbrellas, just because there's the singing dialogue. One thing I love about Demi is he basically he has his own universe. You know, this is way, way before Marvel, and it's an art,
art film,
yep. But it's kind of self-contained in his work, which I think was, that I think is pretty groundbreaking for the time.
Yeah, yeah, I definitely hope to get to those someday.
Yep. Nice. So kind of winding up, Josh, I did want to, you know, just plug again and just, you know, any final thoughts. Of course, Jacques Demy was married to Agnès Varda. And, you know, what you thought of that marathon. It's one that I'm kind of catching up with myself. I think I'm a couple of films in and trying to get some stuff from the library, of course. But it sounds like you guys had, both of you, I think your favorite film was Vagabond, which is in the four films by Agnès Varda box set from Criterion.
Yep.
Yes, Sandrine Bonnaire. I'm sorry. I hear Vagabond. I can't shut up. So go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, that was a revelation, that film, Vagabond. I think I had gone into this marathon assuming what I think is the common narrative on Varda is that she made a great film, Cleo from 5 to 7, which is the one I had seen before we did the marathon, 1962, very much in the manner of the French New Wave films we were just referring by Truffaut and Godard, I think, distinct in crucial ways, but also in that disassembling mode. And then I just thought, I know she knew she made a ton of other films, but I'd heard of Vagabond, heard good things. I'd heard of The Gleaners and I, heard good things, and knew she had her very ardent fans. But I just thought she can't be among those greats like Truffaut and Godard. Well, it's infuriating having done the marathon, and it only added 6 of her films to my knowledge, that she's not regarded as their equals, because Vagabond alone, I think, should put her up there. I really liked One Sings, the Other Doesn't from 1977, which is probably one of her most feminist works, but not polemical at all. And the generosity and the curiosity that she brings to her filmmaking, whether it's the narrative fiction films or her many documentaries, is so unique, and a vision that she holds so lightly, but crucially, that she is one of the top filmmakers I've been able to really explore. And I'm so glad we were able to do it through the marathon.
Yeah, she's the best.
It's still working. Yeah.
Yeah, there was something. Still making films. Was it at Cannes she had something? Yeah. Or, yeah. Yeah, which is just amazing.
Did you get a chance to see Le Bon Heur?
No, so that's probably next on my list of what I want to see. We did, as I mentioned, One Sings, The Other Doesn't, which is fiction. And then we did The Beaches of Agnes and The Gleaners and I, okay. Two documentaries, a really strange one from 1966, fiction / experimental called The Creatures. And then we did her first, La Pointe Court, which is this really interesting mixture of documentary observance within a almost... Before Midnight style walk and talk romance narrative. So yeah, we dipped in here and there, but obviously a lot more I need to get to still.
Yeah, I'd recommend Le Bon Heur. It's kind of the antithesis of the Demy work, which is kind of interesting because it's within a couple years of each other, but tonally, and I don't want to give anything away, but tonally it's very, very different than the way it explores relationships. So yeah, I would try to get to that one if you can. Have you seen that, Mark?
Yeah,
I haven't. That's in the box set. That's the next one up, because it's the four films is La Pointe Court, Cleo, and then Le Bon Heur, and then finishes up with Vagabond.
It's probably
Go ahead, Aaron.
I was going to say it's probably the most twee of Agnès Varda's, but also the least. So
okay. Yeah, and I certainly want to get to some of the ones that more directly touch on her relationship with Demy. There's a bit of that in The Beaches of Agnes from 2008. That's just so fascinating about how that relationship worked and their regard for each other as artists, really.
Right. Yeah, little
plug.
little plug for the box set, Josh, the Jacques Demy box set on Chambre en Ville includes the documentary she did, The World of Jacques Demy, 1995. So some good stuff there.
There you go.
And she's overlooked as a documentarian. She's really a master there, too. And
yeah.
So, but Vagabond, I'm right with you. I think Sandrine Bonnaire's performance in that film is probably among my favorites of the decade. She's just fantastic. So good stuff.
Yeah. That's fair. Completely understandable.
Yeah, something for your Christmas list. Just tell Adam to get you the Demi set for Christmas. There you go.
That would be a great gift.
There you go.
Well, thank you, Josh. We'll wind up. We really appreciate your joining us talking about some Criterion, talking about your book and The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. It's a lot of fun. Where can folks, find you online, find some of your work? We're going to include all the links also, but just give yourself a plug.
Sure. So Film Spotting, you can find wherever you find what you're listening to right now. And Think Christian, you can find at thinkchristian.net. Again, that's faith and culture website. And that's where I do my writing from a theological perspective. The book's out wherever you get books. And if you want to get in touch with me on social media, Twitter, Facebook, you can use Larson on Film, or you can find me as Larson on Film. It's LARSEN. That's the name of my website too. So pretty much everything I talk about on Film Spotting, I write a review of on my website as well.
Excellent. That's great. Thanks again, Josh. And Aaron, do you want to plug Criterion now, where folks could find the show?
Sure. Just on the Criterion Cast feed. Yeah, that's probably where you're listening to it right now. And the Facebook group, Criterion Now. And you can find me on Twitter, AWES505. I wish I had more to say these days, but sometimes I pipe in there. So what about you, Mark?
You can find me on Twitter at Mark Herney, H-U-R-N-E. And I need to update my Letterboxd page. But maybe I'll get some additional thoughts on Demi and Varda on there. So, but yeah, again, we'll include links to all of Josh's work. I highly recommend the book Movies Are Prayers. I'm going to be delving into it soon. Thanks again, Josh, for joining us. Hope to talk to you again sometime on Criterion Now.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Josh. Guys.